the Fed should be raising interest rates, and he's made no secret about that.
So you mentioned he, has been tweeting. He's been tweeting a lot, it seems like. And one thing we should say is he is in the White House and was not supposed to be. He was supposed to be in Florida, right?
Right. He was supposed to go to his Florida club, Mar-a-Lago, and be there with his family. Instead, the First Lady, Melania Trump, had to fly back up to Washington, D.C. to be with him here in Washington. Yesterday, he tweeted, "I am all alone, poor me, in the White House, waiting for the Democrats to come back and make a deal on desperately needed border security." The government shutdown is why he's not in Florida. Last night, he was taking calls from kids as part of the NORAD Santa tracker, and reporters were asking him about the shutdown, and this is what he said.
"Nothing new. Nothing new in the shutdown. Okay. Nothing new.
So you will go
back. Except we need border security."
And for their part, yesterday, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leaders, put out a statement and said, in part, "It's Christmas Eve and President Trump is plunging the country into chaos." They're saying that they're getting different messages from different people in the White House. Every time they talk to someone, they get a different sense of what the president might be willing to accept for the shutdown to end. And so really, negotiations are going nowhere.
All right, let me bring this full circle and just come back to one very specific question that's come up in this conversation. I mean, the president blaming the Fed for what we're seeing in the markets. There's been talk of maybe him even firing the Fed chairman. Is that even possible if the president wanted to fire Jerome Powell?
Well, several of President Trump's advisors, including Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, say that the president understands that he doesn't have that authority. And as far as we know, no president has ever tried to fire the Fed chairman. But the answer isn't entirely clear. The law says that members of the Fed, including the Fed chair, can be removed by the president for cause. And presumably that means breaking the law or something highly unethical, not about a disagreement over interest rates. And that's how it's been interpreted by legal scholars. But that statute hasn't really ever been tested.
Well, and this is a remarkable thing. Uri says that the Treasury Secretary is out there saying the president understands that he can't do this. The president himself did not send out any reassuring tweets on that. All he did was tweet an attack on the Fed.
Ari, let me ask you one other thing that may be related or not. We had this weird news from Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. He was saying that he called top bankers over the weekend to talk about their liquidity. I mean, were there worries about how well banks were able to lend at this moment? What was this all about?
Well, that was what was strange. The economy's doing really well, as we've noted. There's been no concerns raised about the availability of credit, either for consumers or businesses. So for the Treasury Secretary to come out and tweet about his meeting with six top bankers saying that they have ample liquidity, that they can meet the needs of borrowers, it raised more concerns than soothed them and the markets, and the markets didn't respond well to that.
Although the president has conflated the two at times during his presidency, which has confused that a little bit.
Absolutely.
All right. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, NPR's business editor Uri Berliner, thanks so much to you both.
More than 2 million people are incarcerated in the United States, and recidivism is a major concern. Finding a legitimate job is one of the biggest obstacles for people released from prison. The Washington Correction Center for Women outside of Seattle aims to give its inmates a better chance by running a pre-apprenticeship program inside the prison for careers the women may never have envisioned. NPR's Cheryl Corley has the story.
Inside one of the buildings at Washington Correction Center for Women, it looks like a prep site for construction. It's full of cement blocks, wheelbarrows, and wooden frames. Instructor Steve Peterman watches as more than a dozen women wearing bright orange safety vests and hard hats pound nails into the frame.
There's a method here. They got to do so many nails in so many minutes, and they have to do those nails down, on the side and overhead.
Peterman is a retired carpenter. He's been managing the track program, trades-related apprenticeship coaching, for about 6 years. Peterman says in a prison, female inmates may not think about the trades as an option when they leave.
And if they do well in here, can complete their testing, what we can do is we can get them direct entry into a living wage job.
When track graduates finish their prison terms, they have what Peterman calls preferred entry for apprenticeships with four unions, the carpenters, iron workers, laborers, and cement masons. Starting wage first day on the job is about $25 to $26 per hour, and that's important. Many of the women here are single mothers with children. 35-year-old Crystal Lansdale has four children. On this day, she's near the end of her sentence for identity theft and drug offenses, no longer addicted to meth. Lansdale says she made bad decisions she doesn't want to repeat.
The construction trades is something like way out of the box for me, but I need a career that's going to give me retirement, that's going to give me benefits, that's going to give me an opportunity to take care of my kids.
To get into the program, the women have to be in good health. They go through screening that includes testing for math skills and physical agility. For about 16 weeks, the women spend up to 6 hours a day learning about tools and techniques. There's homework and physical work that requires plenty of stamina. Desiree Jensen just completed one exercise.
I was doing the blocks. We have to do a set of 13 blocks back and forth four times in under 11 minutes.
The cinder blocks weigh about 30 pounds apiece.
I did 637. I love it. It gives me a good workout.
Jensen was convicted of assault. She has two daughters. She also has a background in welding and likes math and detail. She's interested in becoming a millwright, a high-precision craftsperson who works with machinery. She says she's plenty motivated.
This is my future. The way I've been living my life the last 30 years isn't working, so it's time I do something else because I'm never going to come back to this place.
Many former felons return to neighborhoods that offer few opportunities, so the women in track get encouragement from others who know what they'll face on the outside.
So I'll start by introducing myself. My name is Lisa Marks.
Lisa Marks is an outreach worker for Northwest Carpenters Institute. She worked building and taking down scaffolding for oil rigs in Washington State and acts as a mentor now for many women working in the construction trades.
Now, when you guys think of carpentry, what is the first thing that comes to mind?
Wood.
Marks is here to tell the women the carpentry union offers eight different apprenticeships. She's also honest about what they'll face, from outright sexism on the job to awkwardness that may come with being the new kid in a field dominated by men. She tells them the job market is more accepting of women and to stay determined.
I mean, I'm not going to say everything's going to be peaches and cream and rosy, because it's not. There's been a lot of times that I've been set up for failure. And you may face that at times, you know, and just know that you do not jeopardize your safety for anybody.
Out on the training floor, inmates are getting timed as they shovel gravel and sand. The women wearing red hard hats are leaders who are paid and help run the classes. 37-year-old Chantel Trotter, who wants to become an iron worker, has four children and was convicted on drug charges. Trotter says track has made her confident, and she wants to pass along the excitement she has about the future to other women she's helped train.
And to be able to walk in here, it's more than just digging ditches and shoveling gravel and carrying heavy things really quickly. It's more of a getting to know who you are, where you want to be.
And learning how to navigate the outside world successfully. In the last 6 years, there have been about 120 graduates of track. Trainer Steve Peterman says there's been about a 3 to 5% recidivism rate, with most women returning to prison for technical work release violations. Late this year, Washington State expanded the pre-apprenticeship to its other women's prison. Peterman says not everyone who starts a trades union apprenticeship makes it all the way through. He has high hopes, though, for Crystal Lansdale and Desiree Jensen, who will start their union apprenticeship soon. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Gig Harbor, Washington.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, 819. And thanks for listening on this Christmas morning. Well, as the 2020 presidential field shapes up, many potential Democratic candidates have something in common: very progressive economic policies, many of which would have been unheard of a few election cycles ago. That story's in 20 minutes here on WPR.
Say you have an idea for a whole new way to sell avocados, but you're not sure if the world wants it. Instagram can help with that. The media, too.
does the world need an avocado bar? And there was yes and no, it was a survey, and 90% of the people responded yes. And so we're like, yeah, that's exactly what we're looking for.
Yep, an avocado bar. I'm Adrian Hill. We'll hear from the guys who started it next time on Marketplace.
Here at Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show giveaways, and logoed business gifts. More about the 4imprint dedication to customer satisfaction is at 4imprint.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Leeward Elite. Shorten your workday, reduce stress, and re-engage with the joy of mission by removing the pain of technology. 5723 6th Avenue, Kenosha. For more information, visit leewardba.com.
The weather looks like for the next few days, cloudy with light snow today and highs in the low to mid-30s. Wednesday, cloudy, rain, snow, possibly both at the same time, highs in the low to mid-30s. And then on Thursday, we start out rainy, changing over to wet snow. The northern part of the state might see some accumulation, gusty winds, and highs from the mid-30s to the low 40s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Tire Rack, offering a tire decision guide to help customers find tires that fit their car and driving conditions. With a network of more than 7,000 independent installers, TireRack.com, helping drivers find, deliver, install. From iDrive, maker of Remote PC, providing real-time remote access to PCs, Macs, and servers from anywhere, for use when telecommuting or for remote management. Learn more at remotepc.com/NPR. And from Frederica and Howard Stevenson, supporting Olin College, which is working to help the next generation of engineers develop the entrepreneurial skills, experience, and mindset to bring technological innovations to market. Learn more at olin.edu.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. In the town of Enid, Oklahoma, there's a tight-knit community of immigrants from the Marshall Islands. After World War II and up until the 1980s, their homeland in the South Pacific was a U.S.-administered territory. And for over a decade, in the 1940s and 50s, the Americans used it for nuclear bomb tests. A treaty now allows Marshallese to come to the U.S. and to live and work as indefinite legal residents. But in Oklahoma, as non-citizens, they get neither state nor federal health care services. Reporter Sarah Craig has the story.
The Enid Community Clinic is nestled in a row of run-down brick storefronts. The pharmacy and auto shop on either side closed for good.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm fine.
Good, good, good.
Dinah Josiah shuffles inside, leaning on her granddaughter for support. She wears a floral muumuu, like most Marshallese women.
Remember me?
Yeah.
I'm Janet.
Yes.
Okay.
Josiah came to see nurse Janet Cordell for her diabetes.
So you're taking your medicine?
Yeah.
Okay. How often are you taking it?
All every morning and night.
Good. You have to take it until it's all gone.
Josiah's kidneys are failing, and she needs regular dialysis. But she can't get it, because like most Marshallese in Enid, she's uninsured. It's been that way since 1996, when the Marshallese lost access to Medicaid and Medicare. All she has is this charity clinic.
I don't know what to tell you. We'll help you as much as we can, and you need to remember that.
Okay.
Taking your medicine, keeping your diabetes under control is going to help, but it's not going to cure it.
Thank you.
We'll see you later. Give me a hug.
The first Marshallese came to Enid to attend a Christian college. Now they come knowing there are jobs at a meatpacking plant.
In the middle of the vast Pacific Ocean lies the tiny coral atoll of Bikini.
But they might not have come at all if it hadn't been for the nuclear tests.
With the atom bomb.
After World War II, the U.S. military took control of the Marshall Islands. They started moving people from island to island to clear a path for the bombs.
3, 2, 1, 0.
Between 1946 and 1958, they detonated 67 nuclear weapons. Dinah Josiah remembers, as a little girl, seeing the Bravo test, the biggest and most destructive bomb ever detonated. It carried the force of 1,000 Hiroshimas.
She said it's like a real bright color, like a fire.
That was 1954. Dangerous clouds drifted across the islands, radioactive pulverized coral dust coating homes and people. Josiah remembers seeing people with burns all over their bodies and their hair falling out. In the following years, people developed thyroid problems and cancer. Babies were born deformed. And Dinah's convinced the bomb made her sick, too.
She believed that all her ill issues are coming from the nuclear testing,
including her diabetes. The idea that radiation could lead to diabetes, it might sound strange, but there's a connection. The bombs contaminated their traditional foods, like coconuts, fish, and breadfruit. They were too dangerous to eat. And so the Marshallese started to eat processed, imported foods, like Spam and white rice. Another Enid resident, Terry Mote, spent his childhood on the islands eating that way. He's now 42, too young by decades to remember the bombs.
We begin to be like, you know, eating canned meat is a good thing. But then, at the end of the day, it's not good.
Today, the Marshallese have among the highest rates of diabetes in the world.
Our environment is not safe. It's still contaminated.
Mote lives with his wife, Lynn, and their five kids. His mom, Mojina, lives with them too. He works at the county health department, and he's always thinking about the health problems in his community.
Teach me to walk
even in church.
In the light of Islam.
After the service, Mote talks to the youth group about being healthy.
What time you should go to bed?
9.
11?
9.
It was about 5 years ago that Mote's mom went into the hospital for her diabetes. She was there for months.
We had little knowledge on, you know, when you stay in the hospital for certain days, the bill is running. So by the time she get out from the hospital, I was so surprised.
He says the bill was $50,000, and he could only pay part of it. Mote's mom wasn't insured. That's when he learned she couldn't get Medicaid or Medicare in Oklahoma. None of the Marshallese can.
It's because, number one, is I just want my family to be treated like the rest of those who are eligible for the Medicaid.
Unlike other states, Oklahoma didn't cover them with its own funds after the loss of federal health coverage.
People came to me and asked for help. And they said, hey, can the church help me pay my bills? So I'm like, hey, you know what? There's a lot of problem here.
Mote has asked lawmakers to help, but it's a hard sell because most Marshallese can't vote.
We feel that we're left out by means of someone to represent us.
A 1983 treaty between the U.S. and the Marshall Islands lets Marshallese live here, but they only have limited status. They can apply for citizenship, but most aren't doing so. Terry says he's the only one he knows.
And that's because the law to be a U.S. citizen is so tough on us.
He says most Marshallese find the process intimidating, unaffordable, and then there's the language barrier. And this is a close-knit community. There's no sense of urgency to assimilate. These also stand in the way of getting health care. And most Marshallese think it's taboo to talk about being sick.
I feel frustrated because these people need to be healthy, need to be treated like human beings.
Mote says he's applying for citizenship because he wants to run for city council. He wants the Marshallese to have a voice.
Why the government came to our island to do 67 bomb testing, and then they're just going to let us die every day?
Some states, like California and Oregon, cover the Marshallese. Oregon has even set up a special insurance program. But Mote's attempts to introduce similar legislation in Oklahoma have failed. But he says he's not giving up. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Craig in Enid, Oklahoma.
That story is part of a reporting partnership between NPR and Kaiser Health News. This is NPR News.
Sir David Attenborough is famous for traveling the world documenting the lives of wild animals. Early in his career, he also recorded musicians he met along the way.
I recorded music wherever I went, if ever I thought stuff was worth recording. And of course, it nearly always is in almost any society you can think of.
I'm Ari Shapiro. We talk with Attenborough about these recordings this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, it's a news update from NPR. Then in the WPR newscast, we'll hear the story of a Wisconsin woman being considered for sainthood in the Catholic Church. Details of that and the rest of the latest news on the way.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Global stock markets traded sharply lower today. Japan's Nikkei average fell 5.1%, reflecting investor worries following yesterday's big decline on Wall Street. The BBC's Ben Lowings reports stocks also closed lower today in Thailand and Taiwan.
America's economic fundamentals seem to be sound, with unemployment at its lowest level for decades. But there's much nervousness. There's been another government shutdown, and President Trump has been angrily disputing the interest rate policies of the man he selected to lead the U.S. central bank. U.S. stocks had their worst Christmas Eve and are on track for their worst December since the Great Depression.
The BBC's Ben Lowings. Despite the federal government's partial shutdown, the U.S. Department of Agriculture says food safety inspectors will stay on the job this week. NPR's Dan Charles reports USDA funds will also be available to farmers and low-income consumers.
Beef slaughterhouses and chicken processing plants cannot legally operate if USDA inspectors aren't there to watch the operation. So those inspectors are still on the payroll. So are federal workers who make sure animals are fed and plants are watered at the USDA's research labs. People who get federal help buying food through the SNAP program will get their benefits. Most farmers who get aid from the government also will.
Dan Charles reporting. This is NPR News.
This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio, 8:31 now. I'm Melissa Ingalls. A nun from La Crosse is officially being considered for sainthood in the Catholic Church. U.S. Catholic bishops unanimously agreed to open a cause for canonization of Sister Thea Bowman. Originally from Mississippi, Bowman moved to Wisconsin at age 15 and became the first African-American member of the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. FSPA President Sister Eileen McKenzie says Bowman dedicated her life to civil rights and promoting acceptance within the church.
There's a real need in our society and in our church for the witness that Sister Thea, just lived her life all about. And that was about equity, and it was about rights and about dignity.
Bowman died in 1990. In May, she was declared a servant of God, a first step toward sainthood. Wisconsin's largest distillery is on the path to new ownership after filing for bankruptcy last month. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that local competitor Dancing Goat Distillery in Cambridge submitted the winning bid of nearly $2.5 million at a bankruptcy auction last week for Death's Door Distillery in Middleton, a suburb just 6 miles west of Madison. Dancing Goat partner Travis Hassa says Death's Door aligned well because it's a Wisconsin brand with a good Wisconsin story. He says a closing will likely be held in early January. Death's Door filed for bankruptcy in November after sales plateaued and the company faced $6 million in debt to more than 100 creditors. The bankrupt company's 25,000-square-foot distillery isn't part of the sale since Death's Door leases the property. Authorities in Fond du Lac are thanking a passerby for rescuing two children who fell through the ice. Authorities were called around 9 a.m. Sunday about two children trapped in a frozen pond on Fond du Lac's south side. Responders were on their way when they learned a passerby had entered the water to help rescue the children. The Fond du Lac reporter says when responders arrived, they found all three were out of the water. Paramedics and firefighters evaluated them and determined they did not need to go to the hospital. Fond du Lac Fire and Rescue Lieutenant Kurt Smits says, quote, "It could have been a very different outcome if the citizen wasn't passing by at the moment the children went into the pond." Cloudy with light snow showers today, highs in the low to mid-30s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features, presenting Mary, Queen of Scots. A rebellious young queen stops at nothing to reclaim her throne. Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie star as warring queens, now playing in theaters everywhere. And from Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Office locations are at visitingangels.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. Actor Kevin Spacey is facing a felony charge for alleged sexual assault. He's accused of assaulting an 18-year-old man at a Nantucket restaurant in 2016. He's expected to be arraigned on January 7th. Now, right around the time that news broke yesterday, Spacey posted a video to YouTube. It seems like he's riffing on the character he once played, Frank Underwood from the Netflix series House of Cards. He talks directly to the camera, as Underwood did.
So we're not done, no matter what anyone says. And besides, I know what you want. You want me back.
Spacey was cut from the show last year after other men accused him of sexual harassment and assault. Alyssa Wilkinson is a film critic for Vox. She's been reporting on men in Hollywood who are accused of sexual misconduct. Good morning, Alyssa.
Good morning.
So we don't know if this video that Spacey posted is in response to the allegations, but it is bizarre. Can you describe what makes it so odd?
Spacey has basically been off the radar since the accusations appeared last year, which is almost exactly a year ago, against him. And it was posted then about 15 minutes after the story broke about his coming arraignment in Nantucket. So that was very bizarre. But I think what's even more strange is that the character that he's playing, the accent he's taken on, is for this character who is sort of a supervillain. You know, Frank Underwood is the central character in House of Cards, but he's also a lying, conniving murderer who basically kills his way to the top and becomes president of the United States. And the one thing you know about Frank Underwood, if you've ever watched the show, is that nobody can ever trust him to ever tell the truth. So it's a very odd choice, at minimum, to choose to use Frank Underwood's character to make what appears to be a defense of Spacey.
How has Spacey tried to defend himself against allegations in the past? Because there have been others.
There have, yeah. So the big one that came out last fall was Anthony Rapp, the Broadway actor, accused Spacey of unwanted sexual advancement when Rapp was 14. And in response, Spacey said on Twitter that he was going to, you know, take some time to reflect and be honest, and that as part of that, he was going to live as a gay man. That's where he put it, how he put it. He said, I want to deal with this openly and honestly, and that starts with examining my own behavior. And then that's kind of the last anyone heard of him, but he came under criticism for that, you know, since the allegations weren't that he was gay or something like that, but rather that he had made these unwanted advances towards an underage person. So that was the last time that we saw him in public, was trying to sort of deflect these allegations by doing something, you know, unrelated in response.
Alyssa, you've looked at other cases of men in Hollywood who've tried unsuccessfully to defuse allegations of misconduct. In the short time we have left, why do these attempts seem to fall short?
You know, it seems as if a lot of these men, for instance, Harvey Weinstein or maybe Louis C.K., have a sense of their own celebrity that's kind of insulated them from the reality of both the allegations and of the seriousness of them. And, you know, if you look at a lot of apologies that have come out from different people who've been accused of things, they often don't really address the underlying issue, but rather try to go in a different direction. And it just sort of feels like they're completely out of touch with, you know, with the seriousness of what they've done and why people are upset with them about it.
Film critic Alyssa Wilkinson of Vox, thanks so much.
Thank you.
With November's midterm elections already a distant memory, Democrats are now shuffling to see who will top their ticket on Election Day in 2020. And a part of that is, of course, testing out new policies. As NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports, some of their economic ideas would have been unthinkable for mainstream candidates just a few elections ago.
Early this month, Bernie Sanders appeared on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, where he took a victory lap for one of his signature policies.
A few years ago, when we said that we should create a Medicare for all single-payer system, I was sold, I'm crazy, it's extreme, I'm a fringe guy. 70% of the American people in the last polls that I've seen now support Medicare for all.
When Sanders introduced a Medicare for all bill in 2013, he had zero co-sponsors. In 2017, he had 16, several of them now rumored to be running for president in 2020. And that's part of a bigger trend around Democrats and economic policy.
I think it's pretty clear that Democrats are swinging for the fences right now.
That's Stephanie Kelton, an economic advisor to Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. It's not just Medicare for All. Some of the most prominent 2020 names are backing other sweeping and uber-progressive policy changes. Those include a $15 minimum wage, debt-free college, and guaranteed jobs, just to name a handful.
There's a kind of a nuance or a specificity to the signaling in this round that looks kind of different to me.
That's Jared Bernstein, who served as an economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden.
I think there's more kind of checking a box by progressive candidates that they're willing to get outside the box. Too many boxes in that phrase, but you know what I mean.
Given how outside the box some of these proposals are, they also draw economic criticisms. For example, even left-leaning economists have said a $15 minimum wage is too high. And a Medicare for All program would mean overhauling a huge sector of the economy. Bernstein knows many of these criticisms exist. He even makes some himself. But he stops short of shutting these policy ideas down completely.
I would actually caution many of my fellow kind of progressive wonks out there not to immediately reject these ideas because of their technocratic limitations.
Is that a nice way of saying, like, some of these policies aren't, like, they wouldn't work exactly as they are laid out?
It's more that they're not really laid out.
Okay. In other words, he thinks these Democrats have some admirable goals, but in many cases need to workshop the policies that would get them there. Even enacting these policies is practically impossible in this political environment. But Kelton believes that pitching these ideas now is the first step in a years-long project of building out the safety net.
It's important to put these things on the table and to begin that conversation because as support builds around them, it can become increasingly difficult for lawmakers to resist acting.
There will be plenty of pushback. Michael Strain of the right-leaning American Enterprise Institute is skeptical at best of many of these early Democratic economic proposals.
All of them strike me as a really bad idea. Certainly, I don't like any of them, and I can't even think of any where I'm kind of shrugging my shoulders.
And of course, progressives aren't the only Democrats plotting presidential runs. While people like Sanders and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren are staking out the liberal territory, other would-be candidates are differentiating themselves. At a Washington think tank event this spring, former Vice President Joe Biden distanced himself from Sanders' populist rhetoric.
I love Bernie, but I'm not Bernie Sanders. I don't think 500 billionaires are the reason why we're in trouble.
Fortunately, all 2020 candidates have a little over a year to show voters what they stand for. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
And this is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio and 8:42 right now. Yet to come, you didn't really think we'd get through Christmas without the essay that launched the career of writer David Sedaris, now did you? Santaland Diaries is back more than 25 years after its first airing in 9 minutes.
WPR has been a radio pioneer for more than 100 years. Today, listener support is the largest source of funding. As a donor, you can be proud of the history you've created. Thanks to you, WPR's future includes more in-depth news, world-class music, and great discussions. Continue the spirit of innovation. Make your year-end gift now at WPR.org, and thank you.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Alumni Association, committed to preparing today's students to succeed in tomorrow's workforce through the University of Wisconsin's annual campaign. More at supportuw.org.
The Gateway Radio Reading Service is for visually impaired listeners who'd like to have local newspapers and books read to them. In the Kenosha-Racine area, specially tuned, easy-to-operate radios are available free of charge. Visit WGTD.org or dial 564-3870.
Good morning. You're listening to WPR. I'm Melissa Ingalls, and here are some of the top stories we're following today. Pope Francis has offered his Christmas wish for fraternity among people of different faiths, races, or ideas, urging the world to put aside, quote, partisan interests to find a political solution to wars in Syria and Yemen and conflicts in Ukraine and on the Korean Peninsula. Asian markets have declined, with Japanese shares suffering a particularly steep drop. The losses follow a big Wall Street decline that was set off after President Trump took to Twitter to attack the U.S. Central Bank. There's more news from NPR and WPR on our website. Go to WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Tire Rack, with more than 500 tire models from 22 manufacturers and an online tool for finding tires based on vehicle needs, budget, and brand. TireRack.com, helping drivers find, deliver, install. And from Atlassian, a collaboration software company powering teams around the world, committed to providing the tools and practices to help teams plan, track, build, and work better together. More at Atlassian.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green. Good morning. Donating to good causes around the holiday season can actually be a pretty daunting process. There are a lot of registered charities out there to pick from. And then there's never a shortage of scammers who are looking to take money out of generous donors' hands. So how do you go about identifying a worthy charity while avoiding being taken advantage of? Well, let's ask someone who knows. It's Michael Thatcher. He's the CEO and president of Charity Navigator. They're the nation's largest online event evaluator of charities, and he joins me from Boston. Mr. Thatcher, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thanks for taking the time. So what are some of the biggest mistakes people make when they're looking to be generous this time of year?
I think one thing that happens is that we react too quickly. So we get caught up in the energy of someone pitching something, and we don't think before we give.
It's like, this cause sounds like something really important. I've got to give money right now and make this happen.
Exactly. It sounds fantastic. The story is very compelling, and I just write a check. One thing to do is just take that breath and think a little bit and do a quick spot check. Simplest thing you can do, is it a registered nonprofit in the United States? Easy way to do that is come to Charity Navigator. If it's registered, you'll find it in the database. If it's not, you should be asking yourself some questions.
So any place that is registered as a nonprofit, does that mean they're at least legit, or do you need to do more research in certain cases?
I would do more research in the sense that you want to be, first of all, you want to be proactive in your giving. You want to start by really identifying, what are the things that I care about? Once you know that you have a legitimate organization that you're giving to, then how do they function?
Sometimes groups try to get you to give immediately. Like, they'll say, if you give in the next 24 hours, you know, we're going to match the gift, or some corporation is going to match the gift. Are you saying we should resist that kind of pressure and just take our time to make these decisions?
Matching gifts and matching grant campaigns that are run by organizations are actually quite successful. And you normally have a 24-hour period within which you can make your donation. So you may get pressured, but I think it's always worth taking some time.
What are some of the scams out there? Like, what are some of the worst you've seen?
I think the worst scams are literally fake charities. And they tend to pop up at times of crisis. For example, there's been a tsunami in Indonesia. You may have some lookalike name organizations that appear at that time. Be careful. Give to a reputable organization that's actually doing disaster cleanup in something in a situation like this.
There are probably some people who are thinking, all right, you're telling us it doesn't take that much time to research, but I don't have much time at all, so I'm just going to give to an organization that has name recognition, like a Red Cross or a Salvation Army. Is that money well spent if you make a decision like that?
Giving to the big name reputable organizations generally is a good thing, but you need to do a little bit more digging. And why not call them up and say, hey, I've got a certain amount of money I want to give to you. I want to know what you're going to do with it. And then secondarily, if you start supporting an organization, you really ought to feel comfortable calling them up next year at this time. Say, how'd you do with the money that I gave you? Think of it as an investment. You track your investments, track your giving.
Do some follow-up.
Absolutely.
Hold them accountable and see where your money was spent.
Yeah.
All right, Michael Thatcher is the CEO and president of Charity Navigator. They're the largest online evaluator of charities. Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio, 10 minutes before 9 now, and some great holiday specials coming up today. This morning at 9 after Morning Edition, Stephanie Elkins hosts a festive selection of wide-ranging music from WPR's extensive collection of classical holiday recordings. At noon, it's Carols of Christmas Past. Norman Gilliland welcomes Trevor Stevenson and the Madison Bach musicians for an hour of festive music. Included are well-known carols in their original versions that don't get heard much today. At 1, a Madison Symphony holiday concert, and at 2, Christmas at Luther College. More about our holiday specials at wpr.org/holidays.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the United Way of Kenosha County seeks volunteers for a kindergarten tutoring program for the 2018-19 school year starting in February. Volunteers need commit 1 hour a week. Visit KenoshaUnitedWay.org for more information.
UPR is pleased to support Community Connections. For more information, visit ulgm.org.
And the WPR weather forecast, not too bad today, but it might get interesting a little later in the week. Today, cloudy with snow showers and highs in the low to mid-30s. Wednesday, cloudy, rain, snow, possibly mixed together, highs in the low to mid-30s. Thursday starts out with rain and changes over to wet snow. The northern part of the state might see some accumulation. Gusty winds, highs from the mid-30s to low 40s. And on Friday, windy, rain and snow with 5 to 8 inches of accumulation possible in the north, highs from the mid-30s to the low 40s.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. If you think you're stressed out during the holidays, try being one of Santa's little helpers. Before he became a best-selling writer and humorist, David Sedaris worked as a department store elf. Turns out, good tidings of comfort and joy are not all they're cracked up to be. Fortunately for us, back in 1992, Sedaris wrote about the downside of the holidays in a collection of fanciful stories called The Santaland Diaries. So here, once again, is our Morning Edition holiday tradition. David Sedaris as Crumpet the Elf.
I wear green velvet knickers, a forest green velvet smock, and a perky little hat decorated with spangles. This is my work uniform. I have spent the last several days sitting in a crowded, windowless Macy's classroom undergoing the first phases of elf training. You can be an entrance elf, a water cooler elf, a bridge elf, train elf, maze elf, island elf, magic window elf, usher elf, cash register elf, or exit elf. We were given a demonstration of various positions in action, acted out by returning elves who were so on stage and goofy that it made me a little sick to my stomach. I don't know that I could look anyone in the eye and exclaim, "Oh my goodness, I think I see Santa." Or, "Can you close your eyes and make a very special Christmas wish?" Everything these elves say seems to have an exclamation point on the end of it. It makes one's mouth hurt to speak with such forced merriment. It embarrasses me to hear people talk this way. I think I'll be a low-key sort of elf. 22,000 people came to see Santa today, and not all of them were well-behaved. Today I witnessed fistfights and vomiting in magnificent tantrums. The back hallway was jammed with people. There was a line for Santa and a line for the women's bathroom. And one woman, after asking me 1,000 questions already, asked, "Which is the line for the women's bathroom?" And I shouted that I thought it was the line with all the women in it. And she said, "I'm gonna have you fired." I had 2 people say that to me today. "I'm going to have you fired." Go ahead, be my guest. I'm wearing a green velvet costume. It doesn't get any worse than this. Who do these people think they are? "I'm going to have you fired." And I want to lean over and say, "I'm going to have you killed." The overall cutest elf is a fella from Queens named Richie. His elf name is Snowball, and he tends to ham it up with the children, sometimes tumbling down the path to Santa's house. I generally gag when elves get that cute, but Snowball is hands down adorable. You want to put him in your pocket. Yesterday, Snowball and I worked as Santa elves, and I got excited when he started saying things like, "I'd follow you to Santa's house any day, Crumpet." It made me dizzy, his flirtation. By mid-afternoon, I was running into walls. By late afternoon, Snowball had cooled down. By the end of our shift, we were in the bathroom, changing our clothes, and all of a sudden, we were surrounded by five Santas and three other elves. All of them were guys that Snowball had been flirting with. Snowball just leads elves on, elves and Santas. This morning, I worked as an exit elf, telling people in a loud voice, "This way out of Santa Land." A woman was standing at one of the cash registers, paying for her pictures while her son lay beneath her, kicking and heaving, having a tantrum. The woman said, "Riley, if you don't start behaving yourself, Santa's not going to bring you any of those toys you asked for." The child said, "He is too going to bring me toys, liar. He already told me." The woman grabbed my arm and said, "You there, elf. Tell Riley here that if he doesn't start behaving immediately, then Santa's going to change his mind and bring him coal for Christmas." I said that Santa changed his policy and no longer traffics in coal. Instead, if you're bad, he comes to your house and steals things. I told Riley that if he didn't behave himself, Santa was going to take away his TV and all his electrical appliances and leave him in the dark. The woman got a worried look on her face and said, "All right, that's enough." I said, "He's going to take your car and your furniture and all of your towels and blankets and leave you with nothing." The mother said, "No, that's enough. Really." This afternoon, I was stuck being photo elf for Santa Santa. Santa Santa has an elaborate little act for the children. He'll talk to them and give a hearty chuckle and ring his bells, and then he asks them to name their favorite Christmas carol. Santa then asks if they'll sing it for him. The children are shy and don't want to sing out loud, so Santa Santa says, "Oh, little elf, help young Brenda here sing that favorite carol of hers." Late in the afternoon, a child said she didn't know what her favorite Christmas carol was. Santa Santa suggested "Away in a Manger." The girl agreed to it, but didn't want to sing because she didn't know the words. Santa Santa said, "Oh, little elf, come sing Away in the Manger for us." It didn't seem fair that I should have to solo, so I sang it the way Billie Holiday might have sang if she'd put out a Christmas album. "Away in a manger, no crib for a bed. The little Lord Jesus laid down his sweet head." Santa Santa did not allow me to finish. This evening I was sent to be a photo elf. Once a child starts crying, it's all over. Parents had planned to send these pictures as cards or store them away until the child is grown and can lie, claiming to remember the experience. Tonight I saw a woman slap and shake her crying child. She yelled, "Rachel, get on that man's lap and smile or I'll give you something to cry about." Then she sat Rachel on Santa's lap and I took the picture, which supposedly means, on paper, that everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be, that everything is snowy and wonderful. It's not about the child or Santa or Christmas or anything, but the parents' idea of a world they cannot make work for them.
That was David Sedaris reading from his classic essay, The Santa Land Diaries. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green. Merry Christmas.
You can hear Morning Editions weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. To follow developments throughout the day, visit WPR.org. There you can check out statewide reports from WPR's award-winning news team, plus national and global headlines from NPR. A minute before 9 now. Stay with us. Music for the Holiday with Stephanie Elkins is on the way.
There are many things to enjoy in Wisconsin in every season of the year. Wisconsin Public Radio is here 365 days a year to serve you with informative, thought-provoking programs. Thank you to WPR members whose support makes it all possible.
WGTD broadcasts from studios located on the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. In Kenosha and Racine, WGTD is heard at 91.1 FM, Elkhorn at 101.7, Lake Geneva 103.3, and around the world at WGTD.org.